Accession number 13359, Mr. George Richardson, Reel 7.
Mr. G.S. Richardson, Reel 7. What were the conditions on board ship like, Mr. Richardson?
Well, we were sleeping in hammocks, although most of us couldn't really stand the backache that hammocks gave. So most of us just laid our beds on the open deck. We'd been used to sleeping in barracks on floors, and we spread our hammocks with our blankets on open decks, especially when we're going to warmer waters. But the inside of the ship was quite large, and we had three sets of mess timings for the troops to go down to the mess. Each bugle is used to sound out mess times in their own battalion calls, so that we knew when to go down to the mess. And our food was, I would say, better than what we'd been used to ashore with the army rations. I think the rations on board ship. We had also, as we were getting into warmer waters, free drinks issued every morning, mostly lime juice, bottles of lime juice, which were very good. We had quite a large convoy because the whole of the 50th Division was sailing together, and I'd already mentioned that our escort had left us, and it was some 2 days after there was a bulletin put upon the notice board, the daily newspaper, telling us that the Hood had been sunk with most of the crew had been lost. And that had only been sunk 30 miles from our convoy. And actually, the our escort had left to protect our northern flank and to chase the German pocket battleship that had sunk the Hood. And it was Scharnhorst.
What was the discipline like on ship? Was it as strict as it'd been on
shore? We didn't have boots on. We couldn't do much marching or drill, except later on we had to do cleaning weapons and weapon drills. And we didn't have a saluting of officers on board ship that we did, except when we had to go up to speak to any of our officers. Our own officers, our own platoon officers, of course, attended to us every day. Our sergeants always had roll call. We're always called to board drill every morning. And that was when everybody was assembled and checked. But most afternoons we were free to run the ship as we pleased. We were restricted to water because of the amount of troops on. We could buy seawater soap, which is like a black tablet, which gave a very poor lather with the salt water that came out of the sprays. And we were only allowed to use the sprays. Each platoon was allowed different times of the week, because we're on board altogether about 12 weeks. It was quite a long cruise. And the whole cruise was zigzagging across the Atlantic. I think we went a few hundred miles from the American coast before we started going south, and then back, turning east, because we had to change our clocks that many times on board. We didn't know where we were sometimes from one day to another. Sometimes we had to change our clocks in just 2 hours at a time.
It was a long journey.
Yes.
How did you deal with boredom?
Well, at night time, there was quite cheap beer and quite a lot of it. But of course, we knew that we weren't allowed to get drunk. Anybody that got drunk or got fighting, they were immediately clapped into irons. They went into detention straight away, no bother. As it happened, our sergeant, Sergeant Scott, he's senior corporal, Sergeant Dawes, had been regular DLI, 1st Battalion DLI soldiers before the war. And Sergeant Dawes, well, he was later sergeant, he was Corporal Dawes then, had brought a bingo set with him. He knew what troop ships were like, he'd done it before. And he was assembled down on the large mess deck and run a bingo session. But they'd had to make quite a lot of bingo cards. There was that many hundreds playing bingo. After a week or two, there was that much money passing through the bingo games, but the PRO of our battalion, who was Major Watson then, decided that he wanted a percentage of the money for the PRO fund. That was, I think that was the name he gave it. But it was to buy extra things such as name tags and any extras that we had in the battalion. It came out of this fund, and Major Watson was in charge of that for the battalion. And so he, I think it was 10% he took of the takings each bingo session. That was after a week or two. But that was about the only thing. We did have one or two people who could give small concerts. We didn't have any music or anything like that aboard. But we could sit around, sing songs and things like that. During the afternoons, they did get boxing competitions going between companies and between battalions, because we had quite a lot of 8th battalion on our ship. And whenever anybody challenged a sergeant or somebody like that, that would be a bit of a bully, they'd have a grudge match, which was usually up on the deck, and quite a large battle. It was the only time really that a private could battle into a sergeant, and there was even one or two of the officers had fights. But it was all done under the amateur boxing rules, and most of the officers they ruled it with on three sides, you know, give points, and we had only two competitions like that, and usually somebody would open a book and bet on different ones, so they knew were best. We had Coughlin in our buglers. He was quite a good boxer. He had come quite a few rounds. What was his name now? I can't think. But he's in charge of buglers towards the end.
As you came to the hotter climates, did conditions become rather uncomfortable?
They were. As a matter of fact, I got a rush, a heat rush, between my legs, and had to report sick quite a few mornings. And they were usually put some blow unction on, and that was it. You weren't excused duties, anything like that. We did have guard duties to do. All our arms were in the armoury. The armoury had to be guarded, and there was a watch on all the decks by proper rotated guards. That was after we'd got out of where we were expected enemy action, away from the North Atlantic.
Was there any grouses during the voyage, particularly in your own cramped conditions, and yet officers were in better class.
They were in better class. Even second lieutenants and first lieutenants didn't have very good accommodation. The ship had been a packet ship going between Liverpool and St. Lawrence. I think that was its regular peacetime role. And it had quite a lot of accommodation, but most of the senior officers had the best accommodation, and there were very, very few sergeants or even sergeant majors at cabins. There wasn't enough room on the ship for that, because we were all absolutely loaded to the gunwales with troops and all our arms.
And you accepted this kind of status?
I know there was quite a lot of grumbles, especially some of the other battalion were right down the bottom. I went down there to have a look. There was a large swimming pool. I think I'd been on the ship about 3 weeks before I found there was a large swimming pool down. And at first, it had been used, being emptied, and then they were sleeping in the bottom of the swimming pool. But gradually they'd found out that they could fill it up with seawater, and it was a good way of getting a few hundred baths at the same time. The swimming pool. But that was way down in about the seventh deck down. I did go on one or two quartermaster's duties where we had to carry things from the bottom holds up to the large galleys. And so quite a lot of the ship going around.
Were you able to continue your own training? Your own single work?
After we got away from the North Atlantic, the Georgic had quite a lot of the Royal Corps of Singles, and they decided to give us some single training with land. And they had a large toy. All the singles, both the 8th Battalion and the 6th Battalion singles, went up onto the open deck, and we had to read messages. We only had a small lamp on our ship to answer back, but it was quite a large lamp that we used, and quite fairly easy to use. But we didn't have much chance to do our more semaphore training. Later on, the troops did manage to get some arms from the armory to do some rifle training and keep us in practice, but that wasn't for a long time. Apparently the Merchant Navy don't like troops on board to be armed, even though we were sailing out to go to war.
Did you have any ceremonies of any kind on the ship?
There was one when the Exeter lost its seaboard. It went up, it used to go up every morning, fly around the convoy and then land, and the Exeter would pull it up, and one day it went out and it came a bundle down into the sea. They managed to get the pilot, and we had a burial at sea. Every Sunday morning we would have some kind of church parade. Mostly by the captain. We did have parties on board ship, and I did manage to get to one or two communion service, because I've always gone to communion. And I managed to go to communion once or twice, but that was about the only other rank, most of the officers that went there. The same as when we were in the line in the desert. I used to go back into Rear Battalion headquarters where the padre was, and he would hold a communion service, and I used to go back there now and again when the conditions were good enough.
Where did you call? Which places did you call in?
Our first port of stop for 3 days was at Sierra Leone, but we were I would say about a mile and a half off. The bomb boats all came out. The ship filled up with fuel, fresh water and oil, and these bumboats rowed themselves out, they threw a line up, and the fruit was coming up and down in baskets, mostly mangoes and tropical fruits like that, pineapples, one too. Yeah, always had to send the money down before they'd send the fruit up. There, nowhere. And there was quite a few of them shouting for Glasgow Tanner, George. This is, for some reason, all foreigners seem to call us George. So it was Glasgow Tanner, George, and if we threw a coin down, they'd dive overboard and usually come up with it. Of course, it was deep water that was standing in. I suppose the bottom that I was littered with silver and coppers. After 3 days, while we were there, the convoy was attacked by an aircraft, Italian, and it was shot down by the Exeter. It did, I think, two runovers, the convoy. I think it dropped a couple of bombs. I don't think it hit anything. But we heard that it had come from Sri Lanka, and that was about the only incident that we had after we left the North Atlantic.
What happened to you as troops with this attack going on? Were you watching it?
Oh, yes.
Were you sent somewhere?
No, there was nowhere to go. And I suppose we were told to get into our steel helmets. I can't remember. I know, I was watching it. I was watching it fly around. But the Exeter was bombing away at it, and it eventually finished up in the sea. There was no more incidents after that. We sailed more or less direct south, right around South Africa. We used to sit and watch the porpoises that fall along the ship. Porpoises and... you know, flying fish. And we used to watch the different ships at each side. Some were very slow, and the convoy used to be signalling all the time to change. I suppose the flag officer on the Exeter had charge of the convoy, and he would send flag signals. Want to change course, and sometimes the lesser escorts would be flashing lights between them all the time. We were trying to read them, but they were never in direct line with our ship, so we had sometimes a hard job to read the more stuff that they were sending, and besides, we were going very fast.
What were your feelings about this journey, the longest journey of your life?
It was 12 weeks, and I was quite excited. Somewhere I knew I was going to. I'd always been interested in geography at school, and there was somewhere to go. And the war had been just going along nice and steady, except for a big loss and the withdrawal of Dunkirk. The war hadn't been affecting us much. We knew that there was a war going on in the Middle East, but even then it wasn't much. It was just ITIs fighting our desert army, which was only a small army then.
The thoughts that you were going into action at some stage wasn't concerning you?
Well, not me in particular. As a matter of fact, all my attitude throughout was, well, okay, if you're going in, you've got to do your best. I just assume he prepares before I'm in action, and during action sometimes when things have got really hot. And I thought, well, either be keeled outright, or don't come out with legs missing. That was one of my things. I used to always dread or come out and finish up either blind or with legs amputated. I thought, well, I'd rather be dead altogether. But that became later, a lot later, after we'd arrived.
Was that the attitude of most men around you on this journey?
Well, I think we'll... As infantry, we'd been that trained, remembering that about a third of our battalion had already come out from one big action in pre-Dunkirk days. We'd been reinforced by about 400 from Argyll, Southern Highlanders, and hours that had been trained by the Dermanite Infantry and joined our battalions. So some of us had never seen any action before, but a third of the battalion had. So, and there was quite a good smattering of regular army, mostly sergeants and corporals, in our battalion. Mostly from the the 2nd or the 1st Battalion Downs.
Did the veterans who had seen some action, did they help in any way? In the sense that you may be going into action and
No, I don't think so, no. All they could talk about was how they'd been led down by the Royal Air Force that when we had to retreat. They didn't have the weapons, the tanks that the Germans had, and there was a big disappointment about the way our army was compared to the German army.
Did you call in any other places?
Oh, yes. We sailed round quite close. We could see Cape Good Hope, Table Mountain, as we sailed round Cape Town, and then we part of our convoy pulled in at Cape Town. Our brigade all pulled in at Durban. Our brigade and most of our supporting troops came into Durban. And that was the first time we allowed ashore. We were there for 3 days. And we went, and Durban was quite a large town. And the Durban people more or less opened their houses and their hearth stores. The very strong population of ex-British people, and we had invitations out to meet some of them. I remember we went into a large church hall where they had all kinds of aids all laid out on the table. We just went in and just sat down and served us anything we wanted. And lady came up, and I was with Harry Richardson, who was a signal line in my platoon, and asked us if we would like to go to dinner. I think this was the second night we're in Durban. And they gave us the directions and address, and we went in the afternoon. And they accepted us into their house. They had about 3 African servants, and they did everything that we wanted and gave us a good dinner. And then they took us down into Durban and paid for us to go into the large cinema in Durban. So I had quite a good night there. And while we were in Durban, the whole of our brigade did a march past in the Durban Cricket Ground. I'd often heard of the Durban Cricket Ground with the test matches before the war, and I never thought I'd see it, but we did a large march past our brigadier and general and all the dignitaries of Durban. All the Durban people were all sitting around in the stands, and the 3 battalions of Durham's went past at our regimental march past, 160 to the minute, march into the regimental march, which is their leg bark. And the rest of the arms that were with us, the artillery and Royal Ordnance Corps, Royal Corps of Signals. As a matter of fact, I think it was a Royal Corps of Signals band that were playing. We didn't have a Dermot Infantry band. And it was quite I enjoyed it. Always have enjoyed the ceremony.
Did you take on any additional troops at Durban?
Yes. We thought we were a full ship until then. And on the last day, quite a lot of Indian troops, commanded by British officers, came aboard, and they were mostly put up on the top decks, on the open decks, There was no room below decks. We had all the quarters. I think there must have been 200, maybe 300. There had been some New Zealanders, I know, that were going to come aboard, but for some reason, as far as I can remember, we only took on these and a few Royal Air Force. Some Royal Air Force had been training in South Africa, pilots and ground crew, and they came with us to our next, well, our final stop. The next stop after Durban was Aden. We pulled in at Aden and we took on water and fuel again, some food, and then we went aloud ashore at Aden, and then we sailed for up the Red Sea, up to Port Tewfik, and the barges came in and were taken ashore. Once all the troops were ashore, we were put on trains and taken up the Delta to a large camp just outside Ismailia.
What were your first impressions of Egypt?
It was absolutely hot and filthy and stinking. I remember where the first Egyptians that we saw were those running along the train, shouting, you know, when the train was going only slowly along the desert, and they were shouting to throw out food or money, and when they didn't, they would just bend down and lift the lift along dresses up and show their bare backsides, and it was absolutely filthy. There were. I remember on this long train journey, we were just looking out, and somebody said, "Oh, there's a mirage over there." And I looked, I says, "What do you mean, mirage?" He said, "Well, look, you can see the top of a ship." And I looked over, I says, "Yeah, there's a funnels in the top mast." I says, "That's the Suez Canal." "Suez Canal? Surely." And it was. There was a ship going on. You could see it was the top from the train, top of the ship. And we arrived at Ismailia, and they took us 2 or 3 miles by Royal Army Service Corps truck into a large tented camp.
What date would this be?
I think it was, we'd sailed in May, it was in 12 weeks, beginning in July. At the end of June or beginning of June, I think it was the 4th of May we'd sailed, I'm not quite sure of the dates. I never kept a diary, weren't allowed to. And weren't allowed to have cameras, anything like that, because we were going to be frontline troops. So, dates, no. Except for the main dates that have stuck in my mind, no, I can't really say.
The camp you went into, what was it like?
Well, there was plenty of running water, and very dusty, very hot, because it was right in the middle of the summer. And we had early morning tea. I think it was Rivali 6:30 tea. Then we had to do half an hour PT, and then a wash down. And I remember on the about the second morning, there's one or two of the town, even as early as I would say 7:30, got sunburned. And one of my mates, because he was ginger, Jimmy Sixsmith, had one massive blister right down his back with the sun. He was burnt. And that was just running about in our PT shorts without any shirt. But except for minor sunburns, I didn't really burn.
Were there excused duties?
That they mustn't take the shirts off in future. The Theo sorted out those that had skin problems with his own, and they were excused stripping down. I suppose that order still stands. We were there about 2 weeks. I managed to do a little bit of walking around in the afternoon, because we only did weapon training, weapon cleaning in the mornings, platoon inspections every morning, and I had to try and get back the discipline that we'd lost on board ship. Orders came out, of course, that we had to salute all officers as we always had done before. Whereas on board ship, there was that many strumming around in such close areas that nobody wore hats, so we didn't have to salute.